I'm Bill Barol. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 13, 6 Feet from Genius.
Dear Bill, I sometimes joke to people who haven't seen my act for a while and are about to, that it's the same old shit. And aside from the underlying self-depreciation of that knee-jerk response, which is something between me and my therapist, it's never actually true. I'm going to talk here about the two ways to live a creative life when you have an act. But first, let's understand that when I say an act, I don't just mean people like me who perform a literal act. It's a phrase that can be stretched enough to apply to pretty much any artist. The way Hemingway writes in simple, short, solidly functional sentences, that's old Ernie's act. The way Sinatra lazily pushes back his vocals in the same way he pushes back his hat, that's his act. The way Jackie Chan uses found props in his fight choreography and is always the underdog, his act. This isn't always as obvious as these examples, and I can understand that some might feel this is a slightly reductive way to describe the way someone approaches creative work, but I disagree. But then again, I would. I have an act. But stick with me long enough for me to make my point, okay? In my business, there are generally two approaches to how to keep moving forward, and at first glance, they seem diametrically opposed. Option 1. You spend a long time honing your act. That's how it used to be done back in the heyday of my art form. You'd work out the bones of a set, and then work it for years, decades, a lifetime, until you knocked so many corners off it and polished it so good it was a mirrored sphere. Good audiences and bad audiences had told you what they loved and hated about it, and you'd listened. And as you grew, so did your 20-minute set, until, with luck and hard work, it got to the point of being as bulletproof as it was bookable. Option 2. You're always making something new. As soon as something you've made works well in front of an audience, well, then it's time to drop it and create something fresh, because that's what being a real artist is. It's not about having made something that works, it's about the process of making, not the destination, the journey. If you're not making something different to what you made before, then you're just treading water, right? I've been around people who took their opinions on this very seriously. Performers who told others to their face that they were hacks because they'd just stuck with an act that worked and never changed it. Other folks who responded with accusations that the genuine artists who were always creating something new had never in fact entertained as well as they might have because they were focused on themselves rather than their audience. It's complicated. And I suspect the answer lies somewhere in between, but we'll get to that. I've been thinking about this from the perspective of myself as a consumer rather than a creator. I'm a huge fan of the novels of the late Robert B. Parker, particularly his Spencer books, which I have read all 40 of several times. They're my comfort food reads, and they serve this role because I know what I'm going to get. I mean, I know exactly what I'm going to get. I've read them all 3 or 4 times, but even if I hadn't, when Dr. Parker published a new one, I could be pretty sure that I was in for Spencer cooking, stilted conversations about codes of honour, Hawk being cool and scary, Susan saying something that takes our hero in a new direction, and gunfights. But what if I bought the new Spencer novel and it was suddenly a troubling political satire that takes Boston's favourite private detective to space, I would not be happy. So when we talk about sticking in your lane and just getting better at the thing you do versus being more free to try different artistic avenues, are we really talking about whether you create for your audience or for yourself? Or at least where in your list of priorities each of these things sits? It must be hard being so successful at one particular kind of creative work that you feel scared to try something different for fear of losing the audience you've gathered. Robert Parker didn't write a book where Spencer goes to space, but he did write novels featuring other protagonists, westerns, and even a couple of romances. Not instead of a Spencer book, but as well as. This is a podcast about the hard work of creativity, and it seems like the hard work here is finding the balance between treading water and swimming in a new direction. Treading water is still hard work and still technically swimming, and you won't lose sight of land and get scared. But maybe you learn to swim so that you could see what's around the edge of the next bay. I am writing this, sitting in my comfy chair by the window. I know what our audience expects from us, and I'm happy to pander to them. Comfy chair, window, all the hits. I'll talk to you soon. Matt.
Dear Matt, I'm a fan of Robert Parker's as well. I interviewed him for Newsweek 100 years ago, over lunch at a bar across from the old Boston PD headquarters. It was apparently his favorite spot because, of course it was. I remember they brought him his regular drink the second he sat down, which I thought was an impressive piece of stagecraft. He was a big guy, like Spencer. Fans liked to conflate him with his detective, and he didn't do much to play that down. And he rolled into the joint like Spencer would have, eyes sweeping the room. It was all part of his act. I remember thinking during the interview that he seemed to have polished his tough guy writer persona, the one he showed to reporters like me, to a high gloss. I don't mean this as a knock. He answered my questions forthrightly, if not expansively. It was just that he'd clearly been asked those questions again and again by reporters like me, who had certain material requirements in terms of their stories, and limited space in which to satisfy them. I always tried to ask interview subjects at least one question they hadn't answered a bazillion times, as a way of keeping them from going fully into autopilot. I can't recall what my change-up was with Parker, but I don't remember him at any point being knocked off his pins, because he was a pro. He knew how to play the hits. But he knew how to work the other side of the street, too. While the Spencer books were for the diehards, you could argue that his three other series, plus 8 standalone fiction titles, well, those were for him. They were the books that let him scratch other itches right from other places. He got to have it both ways. Now, it helped that he was fantastically prolific. In addition to the 40 Spencer books, he wrote more than 30 others. I'm amazed he found time to die. But he did, in 2010, at 77, literally sitting at his desk with the next book in his typewriter. Not a bad way to go for a writer. At a decent age, working, surrounded by your own books. Most of us aren't that lucky. Or lucky enough to embody, as Parker did, both sides of this equation we're talking about in one person. It's more often the case, I think, that there's a push-pull in creative endeavors between people who want to polish the product until it's perfect and then freeze it in amber, and those who want to keep stretching. Sometimes that plays out between artists and their audiences. Sometimes it happens within an artist's own head. My favorite example of this struggle is, just go with me on this, the Beach Boys. Next summer, you'll inevitably see a concert listing for the wheezy oldies act that now gets, after years of backbreaking litigation, to bill itself as the Beach Boys. It's fronted by original singer Mike Love, who, after those same years of litigation, now contractually gets to call himself the group's, quote, founder, which is a lie. The founder of the Beach Boys, as literally everybody in the world who isn't named Mike Love knows, is Brian Wilson. Around 1966, 4 years into their run up the charts, Wilson began to indulge his ear for Baroque orchestrations, ever more ambitious melodies, and lyrics that reflected his own inner turmoil. He had, it immediately became staggeringly apparent, a sublime gift for it. This didn't sit well with Love, who wanted to keep churning out disposable chart fodder about cars and girls and surfing. When Wilson presented the band with the tracks for Pet Sounds, Love famously thought they were, quoting here, offensive and nauseating. Keep in mind, this is the record that started critics comparing Wilson to Mozart, and that so filled Lennon and McCartney with envy that they went into the studio and emerged with Sgt. Pepper. History writes the verdicts on these sorts of beefs, and in the intervening years, it's anointed Wilson a pop music genius on the order of George Gershwin, and Love a litigious asshole with an inflated ego, the Iago of rock and roll, and not for nothing the all-time worst advertisement for lifelong meditation practice. You could argue, I guess, that Love got what he wanted. He got the band name and the air of legitimacy that goes with it, a license to print money off its back, and a platform to grouse eternally about how Brian would have been nothing without him. But Wilson got what he deserved, a recognition in his later years that he's the caretaker of a rare and precious gift. He got singularity. So I guess the question is, who won? It'd be hard to argue in this case that it wasn't Wilson. Swimming gets you places. Treading water is a thing you do to keep from drowning, and the second you stop, you die. But is that always the case? My guess is you think of yourself as somebody who wants to keep trying on new clothes, artistically speaking, because it keeps you growing as an artist and engaged in your art. But isn't there a case to be made that it's also something you do for your audience, that it keeps you from going stale? To flip that question on its head, as a performer, could you make a convincing case for polishing your act to perfection and then locking it in place forever? I'm trying to think of something I may be singularly regarded for. I've been turning that over in my head for most of the day. Can I tell you something? Don't do this. It's depressing. Oh, wait, is it maybe snappy sign-offs? The way I usually but not always manage to avoid falling back on the trite and hacky, I'll talk to you soon? I'll talk to you soon. Bill.
Dear Bill, I am very glad that when you interviewed Robert Parker, he was exactly as he should have been, even if that meant that he wasn't quite as spontaneous an interview subject as you would have liked. He was, as you say, doing his act, both in the books and out of them. Also, is there a human being on the face of the earth who doesn't want to walk into a bar or diner and be presented with their usual without having to say a word? It's a move that simultaneously says cool and also says that you go there too much, which undermines the cool and thus makes you cooler. I once worked a burlesque club regularly enough to get a drink named after me. Only years later did I realise that since it was a variation of an old-fashioned, it may, in fact, have been a sly dig. Who cares? It was strong, delicious, and I got it for free. I've always been intrigued by the whole do one for them and do one for yourself thing. George Clooney is supposed to be someone who does that too, so I guess there's something to be said for doing something for the money, which will keep things ticking over while you make something more personal, artistic, and less profitable. It is at least a strategy which takes into consideration your needs and your audiences, but it feels like with a little more work you could find a way to sometimes do both at the same time. The Beach Boys thing is fascinating. Does Mike Love actually think that he deserves what he got by possibly shady legal shenanigans? I guess if he truly does, then he probably feels like the winner, but the fact that a lot of people who know the Beach Boys' music would struggle to identify him in a lineup, even if that lineup was a photo on one of their albums, answers the question of his victory outside his own head, I think. I guess if you're not an artistic genius, and you know you're not, then you need to grab some money and recognition in the next most available way. Or you could be a decent human, but I guess that wasn't on the table for him. It's a pretty good lesson for our theme on this episode, though. Treading water versus swimming. Staying still creatively versus always developing and making. Brian Wilson made more things. Played, sung, wrote. Mike Love called his lawyers to make sure everyone knew that he was involved in that thing that one time that he didn't even like. Allow me to tell a similar story about the arguably not quite as culturally important British pop group Bucks Fizz. You won't have heard of them. You gotta speed it up, and then you gotta slow it down. They won the Eurovision Song Contest in the 80s and were, for most of that decade, a fairly successful pop band. The 13-year-old me liked them. The 53-and-a-half-year-old me still admits they have some catchy songs, damn it. Anyway, they were a four-piece. Two girls, two boys. They won Eurovision partly because of the power of their bouncy, catchy pop song, partly because they weren't bad-looking, and partly because halfway through the song, the choreography called for the boys to pull off the girls' skirts to reveal, gasp, slightly smaller skirts. This was, is, and always will be as problematic as it sounds, but we didn't realise it back then because we were 13 and it was giving us feelings. The point is that they were a four-piece and they're still going now. Well, kinda. Over the course of their career, they've gone through more lineups than I've gone through Negronis, and it seems like at some point every member has hated every other member. There have been, at varying times, 16 people in Bucks Fizz spread over two different competing versions of the band, one of which, for a decent amount of time, had the rights to use the name Bucks Fizz while comprising no original members at all. Currently, the sole original member who owns the rights to the name doesn't bother touring with a group, whereas the other three originals do perform, but they don't own the name, so they call themselves The Fizz. There's an old BBC documentary that details all of this, and you can find it on YouTube, and it's really worth watching if you'd like to see broadly unlikable people spending all their energy, time, and money on desperately trying to dilute the moderate fame they had decades earlier so that it'll last longer, rather than, oh, I don't know, doing something of more worth, which would be, at this point, anything. It's a beautiful, shabby, low-rent shit show, and I say this as a fan of the band. It is, though, another perfect example of not moving forward, of sitting with that thing you made and not making anything else, and how that can hollow you out and turn you into someone that did a thing and will show you it, rather than someone who does things. You ask if I can make a case for honing that thing that you do and just doing that thing. Trick question, Barol. Obviously, partly because I'm lucky and partly because I decided to do things this way, I kind of do both. I have the act, the Strong 20 that I'll be doing in a few hours' time as I sit here typing in the empty auditorium in London, and I also have my longer shows, my shorter spots, my YouTube channel, all places to keep making new things. But still, you asked a trick question. Way I see it, if you're enough of an artist to be polishing, to be honing, then it's never the same act. You're not treading water, you're moving. Maybe a little slower, maybe only to counteract the tide pulling you out to sea so you stay where you want to be, but still, you're evolving, moving in a direction even if it doesn't look like it from the outside. The difference is that you're using all the creative work to keep something as good as it can be, rather than making something else from scratch. There are, of course, people who don't even hone. Maybe they don't feel the need to, maybe they don't know how, maybe they don't care enough. It's the world of old jokes that use old references that have never been updated. Lines that rely on stereotypes that would have raised eyebrows 30 years ago when they got put into the act, but these days just seem full-on hateful. If you're so oblivious to the world developing and so disconnected from the fun it can be to develop your work along with it, well, then I guess you're not really interested in doing the best work you can, so why do it at all? Is there a place for people who don't even hone or polish? People who learned how to do a thing years ago and haven't really thought of it from an artistic perspective since then? Am I an arsehole to feel superior to them, even when, often, they can go through the motions really well? Or does that signify that I'm wrong, that there's a place for that kind of work? Is honing actually not one end of the artistic argument, but in fact, the middle ground? Well, as I said, I'm writing this sat in the back of a room that'll be full of people in a couple of hours' time. I'm doing a set to close the show. Last week, the Queen died, so it's my job to find something funny to say about that, that won't make people who loved her hate me, but also won't make people who weren't so keen think I'm pandering. This is a fun challenge. Oh, and seriously, go to YouTube and find that Bucks Fizz documentary. If you like hard to sympathise with twits in bad leather jackets having serious discussions about unserious things, everyone comes out of it looking bad. Talk to you soon, Matt.
Dear Matt, I don't want to tell you your business, but it's simply untrue that you wouldn't be able to pick Mike Love out of a group shot of the Beach Boys. There is a dead simple and infallible way to find him. Here it is. In every picture ever taken of the band, Mike Love is the guy who looks like a friend of the band members' dads. This is true currently, in their late years, when Love looks like the guy who never returns the golf cart to its designated corral, forcing your dad to hike all over the senior complex in his space shoes trying to find it. It was true in their middle period, when Love was a dead ringer for the friend of your dad's who wore dashikis, grew his hair out over his bald spot, and used words like groovy and phantasmic. It was true even when they were all in their 20s. Mike Love was just born looking like a mediocre middle-aged white man. There's a 1963 on-stage clip of the band in which Love introduces the guys in turn, Dennis Wilson, then Al Jardine, then Carl Wilson, and then finally Brian. And they kind of build to that moment where they open their mouths to sing and that glorious harmony bursts forth like something from another dimension. And even then, in that moment, you're thinking, right, got it, but who's that friend of their dad's? By the way, in that very clip, Love introduces Brian as, quote,
our leader, Brian Wilson, on the bass.
Which I guess was a slip on his part, and in any event is probably inadmissible in court. Speaking of lameness, I took a look at that YouTube clip of the great Bucks Fizz controversy. They certainly did have some hair. And the tunes were catchy, that is true. But the historical record doesn't exactly cover them in glory. AllMusic.com spends a full third of its article on the group slogging joylessly through its many personnel problems. It also fails, unusually, to list the band members by name. And in the slot marked disbanded, where it usually lists the date of the band's demise, it simply says London, England, as if, exhausted by the degree to which the group's squabbling outshone their performing, it just threw up its hands and said, look, it went on for so long we can't pin it to a date, but we know it happened more or less here. And look, I get it. Bucks Fizz has spent more time in court than it ever did in the charts. It must have been draining even for them. While I'm lobbing up questions, let me lob this one. What is it about mediocre white guys that makes them burn with envy for what they think has been taken from them? But then again, who really cares? I mean, it's not like that's a cultural dynamic that could ever come back to hurt society in any meaningful way. But okay, let's talk about Bucks Fizz for a second. And Mike Love, too, because he makes such a satisfying splat sound when you punch him. You postulate that sitting with a thing hollows you out. This suggests that even those who are permanently stuck in place know that they've wasted their lives, at least creatively speaking, but also, I think, that they don't have the talent to respond in their work. And they know that, too. Is that where the grievance comes from? Mike Love stood 6 feet from genius every night, but the delta between him and Brian Wilson was immeasurably more vast than that, and he had to know it. Is it the envy that turns you from a creative person, or at least someone who was once creativity adjacent, into a litigant? It'd be hard to argue in the case of Love that burnishing his own legend isn't now his work, much more so than anything he does lumbering around the country every summer croaking out Surf and Safari to audiences he never did seem to like very much. And if you believe that every Mike Love, every Bucks Fizzer, and my goodness, there do seem to have been a lot of those, if you believe that this lifetime of grousing and suing and countersuing is what they have in place of talent, and crucially that they know it, does that dispose you to look at them a little more kindly? It does make me feel a little more charitably toward people who are in that middle ground you suggest, the burnishers, the iterators. You gotta try, right? Even if it's just to polish up what you already have. There's a measure of pride in that, and pride is envy's kryptonite. The Bucks Fizz thing does make me want to ask you, by the way, about Eurovision, which is one of those beloved British and European institutions that leaves Americans scratching their heads in bafflement, like the Carry On movies or the nightly shipping forecast on the BBC. What is it about Eurovision that inspires such devotion over there? I'll talk to you next time. Bill.
Dear Bill, I have to correct you on a very important matter. There are not many members of Bucks Fizz. There are four. Bobby G, Mike Nolan, Jay Aston, and the splendid and wonderful Cheryl Baker. All the others are not members, they are employees. And yes, I reeled those names off without looking them up. Cheryl Baker once came to a show that I was in, and the week afterwards sent a lovely letter backstage saying how much she'd enjoyed it. A letter that revealed she lived in a house named Razzmatazz. I'm not sure how sympathetic I feel toward the Mike Loves of the world, but it's sad they weren't able to find a healthier way to exist in the very privileged place that they somehow found themselves in. A lot of people would give a lot to stand 6 feet from genius, to see it close up, to have it be your friend, to learn from it. But there's a certain kind of person who can only see the person 6 feet away as what they aren't. To focus on the differences between you and them rather than the fact that you're all on stage, part of the same band, working together to make something beautiful. For some, the whole hollowing out thing is as much something they're choosing to do as it is something that's happening to them. But I wonder if, for others, it happens kind of more in the background. I think it's one of those things that for some people happens slowly and seductively enough that unless you really keep an eye on it, you don't notice what you're becoming. I had a gig this past weekend in Leeds, which involved me staying one night in a hotel. The evening after that night, I realised that I'd forgotten to take my antidepressant in the morning. It's happened before on the odd occasion, so I knew there was a fair chance that in the next 24 hours my mood would drop, but that it wouldn't last long. But it didn't happen. I got through the next day feeling fine. But the day after that, I was at home working at my desk when suddenly I found myself obsessing over more successful people, comparing them to me and convincing myself that I was worthless. Took me a couple of minutes, but it wasn't long before I thought to myself, why am I suddenly feeling so bitter? Oh, wait. Forgot to take a pill a day and a half ago. And as soon as I realised that, it was pretty easy to deal with. By basically yelling at my internal monologue like a dad yelling upstairs at noisy kids. Hey, pipe down, you're just chemicals. Shut up. But without close monitoring, decent mental health, and in my case and a lot of others, help from medication, envy can be quick to infect. I don't think envy is the thing you have instead of talent or skill. I know plenty of people with both, but it's the thing that is very easy to let grow until it pushes all the other stuff to the back and takes over your soul completely. It's sometimes very hard to avoid that bitterness from becoming dominant inside you. I imagine we've all been there occasionally. I know I have. But a large part of the hard work of creativity, as we call it on this podcast, and indeed the hard work of living kindly, is to learn to sense yourself going down that path and to back up. And remember that you're an artist, so you should make something or be inspired by something. You asked some questions about British culture, so let's address them. Eurovision. Great, silly, bright, camp, and sometimes, when you least expect it, incredibly moving. It's like the Super Bowl or WrestleMania, but for avant-garde, often secretly political, often unsecretly sexy and queer song and dance numbers. It's a huge live competitive TV event that isn't targeted at straight men. Imagine. Carry-on films, viewed from the now, are the perfect fusion of brilliantly crafted comedy by old hands who had honed their timing on stage for decades, and a litany of offensive and very, very wrong opinions and socio-political stances. I used to be friends with Barbara Windsor, who is in all the best Carry-On films. She was lovely, and once, backstage at a theatre in Wales, she held my hand while I had an attack of epilepsy. Finally, the shipping forecast. It's a forecast for ships.
BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015, today Tuesday the 1st of August. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, northwest Malin, 1002, losing its identity.
There's nothing odd or menacing about it at all. Viking. Dogger. Fast net. Rockall. Trafalgar, Fitzroy, just a normal shipping forecast, definitely not a way of activating sleeper agents. Good luck in your mission, Bill. Talk to you soon, Matt.
Dear Matt, okay, now I think I get Eurovision. You have Eurovision, we have Dancing with the Stars. Dancing with the Stars is big, it's bright and campy, but for my money, it's grim, relentless cheerfulness that
"we're all having so much fun"
thing is incredibly wearing. I watched one episode because Shangela, a drag performer I admire, was a contestant, and one episode was about all I had in me. Believe me, if that thing can drain the dazzle from a drag queen, it must be pretty deadly. I can't believe we're 13 episodes into this series, this ongoing conversation about creativity, and only now arriving at the subject of creative envy. Because really, this whole question we've sketched about sticking in place versus moving ahead, it's really, in a way, a discussion of envy, of that special corrosion that eats the soul when you realize someone you're close to, professionally or even personally, is working in a key your instrument just can't produce. We disagree on one thing here. I don't believe it's possible to be so oblivious that you don't notice yourself being taken over by your envy and hollowed out by it, until you're just a shell of a person who looks like a friend of somebody's dad, artistically speaking. The trick is, as you put it, to be self-aware enough to sense yourself going down that envy path and pull up. That's the aspiration, anyway. I suppose there are creative people who are, for practical purposes, sociopaths and lack the ability to discern this awful process as it's happening to them. Maybe these are the people who populate that dark end of the street you've suggested, where even the act of burnishing is just too much. But I don't think that's the norm. I think most of us have at least some sense of where we stand relative to the more talented people in our orbits, and this is the miracle of it. We create anyway. Because on the scale of human needs, creativity may not sit with oxygen and food, but in its way, it's critical to our survival. It's one of the things that marks us out as humans. Imagine knowing that, or at least sensing it at a gut level, even as you recognize that this is a deeply human undertaking in which you just can't fully participate. Think about that. That ought to be enough to make even you, with your cold, cut-glass entertainer's heart, make you feel sorry. Even for Mike Love. Almost. Oh, before I forget, a word about the shipping forecast for listeners over here who may be unfamiliar with it. It is, as the name implies, a marine weather forecast broadcast nightly on the BBC since its earliest days on the air a century ago. It's so perfectly, stupefyingly dull that it's been taken up by listeners in the UK and around the world as a soporific. It literally lulls you to sleep, as indeed it's done for me since I tumbled to it a couple of years ago. At least, it did that until you managed to connect it to a shadowy world of intrigue and hidden geopolitical danger, which is exactly what I want to be thinking about before I go to sleep. So thanks for that. I'll talk to you next time. Bill. Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barole in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barole. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.